Okay, so one of the less understood things about an hour-long podcast is that it actually takes quite a few hours behind the scenes to make. You're lining up different people's schedules, you're writing scripts, editing audio, making it feel effortless actually takes a bit of effort. That's why I want to recommend Notion. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired too, so that when it comes time to hit the record button, everyone's on the same page, or TeamSpace, or Calendar, or QuickNote, have a play around, they're all there. Notion combines your collaborations into one space that's simple and clear, and it also has some AI running in the background to help things along. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/squared. And just an FYI, that's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting what we do here on the show too. That's notion.com/squared.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to this week's episode of Intelligence Squared. Today, we're joined by the award-winning author and investigative journalist Jess Hill to speak about her new book, See What You Made Me Do, Power, Control, and Domestic Abuse. And she spoke to Rosamund Irwin all about our common misconceptions about domestic abuse and also some innovative solutions from around the world to tackle the crisis of gender-based violence and abuse. It's a really interesting conversation, and it challenges us to see domestic abuse through a different lens. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Rosamund Irwin, a journalist at the Sunday Times. Hi, Jess. How are you today?
Hi, Ros. I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. It's a very serious topic for today. But actually, what I liked so much about your book is you also do offer a bit of hope within there. You know, you start at quite a hopeful point. I want to ask, first of all, we treat domestic violence often as though it's a problem that is inevitable. After spending all this time investigating it, how do you feel about that?
I think that given the way that we relate, you know, and the way that we are intimate with each other and all of the vulnerabilities and, you know, sort of extreme emotions that can come with that, that it's going to be very difficult to just extinguish domestic abuse altogether. But I don't think that it's inevitable that we should have it at anywhere near the levels that we have it now, and nor is it inevitable that it should continue to go as unchecked as it is now. And, you know, that's why we talk about sort of in the book around things like focused deterrence, models where you're actually seeing the perpetrator become the focus of not only law enforcement, but community service agencies and the domestic violence sector. And when I say the focus, what I mean is, obviously, the victim's safety is the number one, is the lens through which they're looking. And so the victim is held in safe regard the whole time. But the whole point is to make the perpetrator visible and to make them not only accountable and responsible for their actions, but actually to sort of put in place a system that may support whatever it is they need to possibly change their behavior. But if they can't change their behavior over time, then the full force of the law comes against them. And I think the focused deterrence model is really interesting and has had very promising results in the few years that it's been running. But there are lots of different models around the world that are actually reducing the statistics of domestic abuse, which is the only thing that we can use to measure what is actually going on inside households. Statistics often miss a lot of what is happening, but it's the only way we can get any kind of idea. And I just think that when I started writing this book, I was told by like a lot of different people working within the sector that there was no real way that we could reduce domestic abuse, and that really the only way to come at it was to stop it before it starts by increasing gender equality and working on respectful relationships. But I think that there are a number of strategies worldwide that show that we don't have to wait for attitudes to change over generations, that we can stop this, you know, we can really, or stop this or at least reduce it dramatically within years.
You talk about in the book the case of Deb and Rob. It's right near the beginning, I think even in chapter one. And they're a fascinating couple because, and I'll let you tell the story, but he was abusive and now he counsels men trying to stop them being abusive, which does hint that some people, not everyone, but some people are capable of immense change.
Yeah, I think that, you know, a small percentage, unfortunately, at the moment, with the sorts of mechanisms that we have, like men's behaviour change programs, we see a small percentage who are capable of real total reform. I'm not just talking about men who stop using violence, but men who are able to really address their overblown sense of entitlement, their need for control and domination, and their need to humiliate their partners. But Rob and Deb were a really amazing couple because I went there to their house with my partner, partly to sort of disarm them, because I think sometimes going in as a journalist, it's, you know, people can feel a bit like a specimen under a microscope. So I went there with my partner, who's also a psychotherapist, kind of with the intention of us all sitting around the table and just having a chat about marriage and relationships. And it was really interesting because they'd been about 10 years out of the abusive pattern that Rob had been perpetuating in the relationship. But even as Rob was telling his side of what had sort of woken him up, Deb had to chime in a number of times and say, well, that's not quite how it happened. Actually, what was happening was this. And it was a real reminder that, you know, whenever you're talking to men who've perpetrated abuse or violence, that even if they're years free of it, that there's a narrative that you know, gets into a primary position in their head, which is usually to position themselves, if not as the hero, but as someone who was basically like on their way to discovering it of their own accord, independent of anybody else. And actually, it's not until you speak to a partner or ex-partner that you really get a full sense of what's going on. And I think that with Deb and Rob, why I wanted to put that in the first chapter is that their relationship was absolutely flat out domestic abuse. And Rob was told that by a psychologist he went to see when he went to get treatment for depression and for feelings of suicidality. But there was no physical violence. And really, the sorts of things that were happening were reasonably subtle. Deb was being coerced into compliance with Rob's needs. She was being isolated from friends and supportive connections and family. She was being very subtly degraded. So just jokes, demeaning comments, things that Rob would sort of just try to pass off as insignificant, and then would make her feel even more humiliated for reacting to them. And I think this is what you see so often in domestic abuse, and in really some of the most dangerous relationships, is the level of control creeps up. It's why we use the term coercive control, because often it's not outright domination, it's coercion, it's putting the woman in a position where she feels like she has to change her behavior, modulate her behavior, walk on eggshells, etc., until the woman kind of forgets what it is that she wants or what it is that is actually happening to her, because she's so focused inwards on what can I do to change my behavior so that I can stop him from acting this way, or what can I do to help fix him because he seems like such a broken man. And a lot of women, like Deb Sanasi, really believe that it's them who are the strong ones in the relationship, and that they're actually doing all they can to try to fix their partner. And so it becomes, the whole system of abuse can become invisible right from the get-go.
You say right at the beginning, in terms of the terminology, you originally started talking about domestic violence and you've changed it to domestic abuse. Is that because you felt a need to encompass all this behaviour, some of which isn't, you know, the traditional idea of domestic abuse is somebody beating their partner, but of course there's so many other ways that a relationship can be abusive?
That's right. And, you know, we don't call it child violence. We call it child abuse because it encapsulates all sorts of different treatments, including neglect, including molestation, lots of behaviours that we wouldn't necessarily classify as violence. But I think the real turning point for me came, I wrote this book, you know, much of the time I had a newborn. So I was pushing pram and I was being sort of a bit negligent myself by reading an article as I was pushing the pram, still safe. But I read this article by this woman, Yasmin Khan, who runs a domestic violence organisation in Australia, especially for women from India and Pakistan. And she said that she would so often have women coming into her service saying, well, it's not domestic violence because he's never hit me. But they would then go on to just describe the most horrific campaigns of control that were perpetrated not only by him, but also often by his extended family. And, you know, the most that they'd have happen to them was a cup of tea in the face or something like that, degrading physical attacks, but not what they had classified as violence. And so Yasmin Khan just made it her mission, especially after she visited the UK, actually, and spoke to police there. She made it her mission to change the term from domestic violence to domestic abuse because she was tired of women not being able to see themselves in domestic violence. And I have to say, I confronted that a lot during my research, but also speaking at various festivals and events where women would say to me, but how are you going to communicate the fact that sometimes the physical violence is what hurts the least? And I always had a very substandard answer for that. And so what I thought is, well, the very first thing you've got to change is the term. And so for me, that was about 2 weeks out from print. Everything had already been typeset. The cover had been designed. And I just called my publishers. I knew right away. And I felt nervous about it because domestic violence is a term that even in its own way is completely inadequate to describe the experience and the behaviours within an abusive situation. But I just felt this change was absolutely necessary, and so my publishers went ahead and did it, and I've not regretted it for a second.
We do have this new, relatively new crime in this country of coercive control. How widely recognised, obviously you're Australian, and you've talked about other countries within this book, how widely recognised is that as abuse? I mean, that is a very recent thing in the UK.
I'd say that within the domestic abuse sector, it's widely recognised because, you know, since the 70s, the building, you know, mountain of testimonies from women and children have described the same behaviours over and over again. And it was back in the 70s that a group of feminist psychologists actually coined the term coercive control. So it's been around for a really long time. But I think that outside of the sector, and unfortunately, you know, prior to the laws coming in across the UK and Scotland, I'd say a lot of police and magistrates probably would not have either heard the term or been aware of it. I'd say across the world, I certainly find in Australia that when I started talking about this when the book was released last year, there was a lot of kind of blank faces when I brought up the term coercive control. And what really shocked people, I think, was finding out that the architecture of coercive control, so the behaviours or techniques that a perpetrator will use, are the same. They are repeated over and over again. It's what actually, you know, Rob Sanassi referred to as the perpetrator's handbook, that it, you know, for all the guys that he's spoken to after he'd perpetrated it himself, it just started to feel like to him like they'd all studied the same book. And so even though the behaviours within coercive control, the ways in which it's expressed are different in each relationship, the basic architecture is the same, and it repeats whether the perpetrator is strategic and, you know, and intends to control and dominate, or is doing it almost unconsciously.
And what is that sort of blueprint for establishing power? What are the methods that abusers use, if it's so sort of common, the pattern of what people do?
Well, I think it's really interesting and also, I think, quite important, especially for people who've been victimised by a coercive controller, to understand where our modern understanding of this comes from. And it actually, though the term was coined in the 70s by feminist psychologists, our understanding of how coercive control is constructed comes from the 1950s. And it came from a US Air Force sociologist, Albert Biederman. And the reason why he charted how coercive control works is that during the Korean War, US Air Force and US soldiers were taken prisoner by the communist Chinese. They were taken up to North Korea, put into camps. And over time, it became clear that these soldiers were acting in ways that no one had ever seen before in prisoners of war. They were, you know, making false confessions. They were informing on fellow prisoners. They were giving away information that they had been explicitly trained to keep confidential. And when they were released, there were actually a few of them that defected to communist China. So back in America, when the war was over, there was just this hysteria about what the soldiers had done. And everyone to the, you know, highest levels of the CIA had concluded that the Soviets had some magic brainwashing machine and that there was actually some sort of scientific trick that they'd come upon in which they could basically remove a man's memories and thoughts and install all new ones. And so, you know, the Americans, as they do, went into the lab and started trying to do their own magic brainwashing machine, which of course did not have excellent results. But Albert Biedermann, when all of that hysteria was going around, he just thought, this sounds a lot like propaganda. And has anybody even thought to speak to these men and ask them what they went through? And so he did. He went and interviewed these returned POWs, and they described again and again the same techniques had been used against them, often in isolation, so they hadn't got together and talked about it. And what he boiled it down to was three effects. The three major effects of this pattern that they were subjected to was dependency, debility, and dread. And he isolated eight techniques by which that was achieved. And interestingly, physical violence was not on the list of techniques. And the reason was not because there was a total absence of physical violence. In fact, some of the violence these POWs were subjected to was extreme. But actually, in the most savvy, you know, in the hands of the most savvy captors, the physical violence was minor or barely present, because actually it's what would alert the prisoner to the state they were in. And whereas the psychological abuse that's inherent in coercive control was actually what kept them in this state of altered reality. And so just briefly, the eight techniques, I think it's really important for people who are experiencing this or who have experienced this to understand. It's something that builds. It is a web of abuse. And each technique seen on its own does not necessarily sound that terrible. It's only when it's pulled together that the whole picture of coercive control is clear. So the first technique is to, outside of the eight techniques, actually, the first technique is to establish love and trust. And in the camps, when the Americans were first taken prisoner, they were given a slap on the back, handed some cigarettes, and the communists would tell them, we are friends with the workers of America, we're not going to hurt you. So there was this sense that, okay, maybe we're going to be okay, and that need to believe that. And then the eight techniques that they were subjected to was isolation. They had their perception was monopolized. And so I'll explain just in a minute what that means for domestic abuse victims. They were induced into debility and exhaustion. Their captors enforced trivial demands. They demonstrated omnipotence. They alternated punishments with rewards. They made threats against them, but also against their families back in the United States. And they degraded them. And that is the basic chart of coercion that became, as Amnesty International said in the 70s, this is the internationally recognized form of torture. And essentially, it's used by anyone who trades in a form of captivity, whether that be traffickers, pimps, religious cult leaders, political prisoner takers. And as we found out, once the women and children started fleeing to refuges, domestic abusers.
Are there any signs that traditionally exist where the sort of warning signs that come up in many of these cases? I mean, in some examples that you give in the book, it does feel like someone flicked a switch and somebody who initially seemed charming and lovely and all the things that we might want in a partner suddenly changes.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's kind of like on this spectrum. So in some relationships, you have signs that, you know, I think Laura Richards puts this really well. She was the founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. She puts this really well in the sense that she says that a lot of the first signs of coercive control look like caretaking behavior. So they might be something as simple as, you know, you don't need to drive tonight. I'll drive because you're tired. And then it might be every night you don't drive. And then it might be you never drive. And then it might be that you don't renew your license, you know, and then you don't, you aren't able to drive a car. And the only way you can get around is with your partner. So it's these subtle, gradual things that at first may seem like chivalry. It might seem chivalrous that, and really gorgeous that, that your partner wants to spend every moment with you and wants to know where you are all the time and doesn't seem to be able to live without you until that becomes a trap and a cage. So those, there are signs sometimes in relationships early on, and you hear women say sometimes, I had a feeling, I had this instinct that something was not quite right, but I didn't listen to it because I really wanted to believe in this relationship. And, you know, women like that who have had those relationships and been subjected to this kind of abuse will become much more adept at picking that kind of personality early on. But so often, as you say, you know, there were so many stories in the book and so many women I spoke to whose men would absolutely turn on a dial. And one woman, Sarah, she was a nurse at a trauma hospital. And basically it wasn't until she announced that she was pregnant that her partner just turned on a dime and became one of the most intense coercive controllers I've ever heard. It was, he went from being totally supportive of gender equality and her independence as a professional woman to policing the minutiae of her life, like, you know, saying what time the blinds had to be drawn, trying to forbid her from working. And then when their baby was born and their baby daughter was born with breathing problems, he would refuse to believe that she had breathing problems. And so he would turn off her breathing monitor. He cancelled her health insurance. He would even tip Express breast milk down the drain so that he could control how much milk his daughter was getting. So, you know, here's a guy who looks really congenial, no sign at all of any personal problems, of any jealousy or paranoia, and just in a matter of days turns. And I think Sarah's story is really instructive when people try to sort of pin an abusive situation on the victim as if it's a product of their bad choices or their bad luck. You know, Sarah knew what domestic abuse looked like, and so she, when her partner Carl started acting like this, she told everyone. She told his family, she told her own family, she told doctors, she had him seeing a psychologist. You know, she was totally open about it. But she made the one fundamental mistake which so many women make. And it's a natural mistake because our systems of attachment are such that we want to do this for our partners. And it's not, when I say a mistake, I don't mean that it is a failing on their part, but it is something that often does not work. She tried to fix him without him really putting any effort into him fixing himself.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Jess, one of the things you were talking about there is that we tend to talk to the victim as though, you know, outsiders, non-specialists in the domestic violence or domestic abuse sphere always say, why doesn't she leave, rather than why didn't he stop doing it when he probably, you know, said 1,000 times, oh, I will never do this again. Do you think that we need to change society's attitudes to this, because we put a lot on the victim and we don't really put enough perhaps on the perpetrator?
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the first early learnings I had when I was researching domestic abuse when I started way back in 2014. And I think that, you know, when I came to this subject, I was commissioned actually by an editor here in Australia. And I didn't have any experience with domestic abuse personally. I didn't have any experience writing about anything really related. And I think when I was, I had all of my attention was really on the women and the women. What choices do the women make? What choices don't they make? Why do they stay? Why don't they leave? Why do they go back? And I was at this phone counseling center, which is it's like a family violence helpline. And I was sitting there with the phone counsellors, and they get calls every 2 or 3 minutes. It's extremely busy. And there was just this brief lull in calls. And so I ventured this observation and I said, you know, you must be so frustrated when somebody calls again and they seem like they're ready to leave and then they go back to him. And this phone counsellor looked at me with this pointed stare and just said, no, I'm frustrated that he promised to stop abusing her, but he chose to abuse her again. And it just snapped in me, this sudden reversal. And from that moment, I was obsessed with this topic, because I think the reason why originally I felt a bit bored by the idea of writing about this, like, what was I going to write about? This guy that just comes home and, you know, a bit drunk or something, beats up his wife. You know, I was really naive about it. But suddenly when it flipped like that, and when my attention turned to the perpetrator, and when the question that was suddenly glaringly in front of me was, why on earth does he do it? And that was just, I felt that was years of research to even get a sense of it, to even get a glimmer of it. And actually, I still find it when I hear individual cases, I still can feel absolutely just mind-boggled by why it is that these men who seemingly hate and despise their partners won't let them leave, will kill them for leaving.
Well, that's the obvious fear that hangs over people when they are considering leaving. And I do wonder if sometimes we mistake a woman staying for actually a woman either on the cusp of leaving or somebody who has just left, because of course we know that the most dangerous period for somebody who has left an abusive relationship is the process of leaving and the immediate aftermath.
You know, and I think that we know that, and sometimes women who are experiencing domestic abuse know that. But interestingly, there was a survey done a few years ago in Australia, and I'm sure that these survey results would transpose across various countries. is that the number one reason women were afraid to leave was their fear of destitution. And that was way above their fear of physical violence. And I think that, you know, often when women are looking at leaving, especially someone they're married to or someone they have children with, I mean, think about how much thought goes into that for us, just, you know, in regular relationships where there is no massive power imbalance. And it is such a massive thing to do to leave your partner. Now, imagine if you are, like about 95% of women who are abused, imagine if you are being financially abused, and like about half of British survivors who were surveyed recently, they actually have no access to money. And about 52% of British women survivors said they actually could not afford to leave their abuser because they had no money of their own. So imagine just in a regular situation, thinking about leaving your partner when you have no money, and then add a system of coercive control where that person has been degraded, where they have been threatened, where they believe that their partner, for good reasons, knows everything they are doing at all times and is always one step ahead of them. You know, when they feel like they are just trying to survive day to day, minute to minute, where they feel like they've lost a sense of who they are. Imagine how difficult it is for someone like that to leave. And then pile on what happens to so many women when they do leave. So let's say they try to go through the legal system. Let's say their abuser decides to go for custody and takes them through the family law courts. And suddenly they are in a system which says that even an abusive father is good enough, and you must facilitate contact with that person. A person who may have raped you, who may have threatened your life, who may have threatened the life of your children, suddenly deserves access to those children. Those same children who probably Child Protection Services may have told you, you need to keep away from that person, otherwise we'll remove them from you. You know, so I just think that what women are up against, and I don't just mean women, I mean anyone who is leaving an abusive relationship, but particularly women, is so gigantic that I am astonished when women do leave, because what they are doing is they are stepping into an unknown, and so many women will just decide it is better the devil I know than the devil I don't. And the devil that they don't know is not just the system, but it's also the abusive partner who is no longer in their eyesight, who is no longer, you know, connected to them in what can feel like an almost psychic way, an almost umbilical way, where they can tell by the sound of his footstep, by the shift in a tone of voice, how dangerous he is from moment to moment. When he's out of sight, they can't tell how dangerous he is, and they don't know what they need to be doing in order to make themselves and or their children safe. So the barriers to leaving are just gigantic.
And the role of children here, I mean, clearly we know that at every stage in the abuse, children are involved, that they, you know, they're abused, but they're also used as a sort of something to hold over the partner who is the victim. The risk to them after the partner leaves also does not disappear. What methods are there legally that we can do to protect both the abused spouse and the children if they have successfully managed to leave?
Well, I mean, there just needs to be enormous changes in the ideology of the family law courts, for starters. I mean, in terms of, there's a lot that goes into protecting women and children once they leave, because often the threat of homicide is so great. You know, the refuge system is not perfect, but it's what we've had since the 1970s in cases of, you know, where there is a threat of homicide or there's nowhere for those women and children to go. And yet in England, I think since 2010, 1 in 6 women's refuges have been closed down. That's not because domestic violence has been going down. That's because of austerity measures. And what raises domestic violence? Austerity, economic recession, you know, economic insecurity. So at the very time when those services needed to be fortified, they were being stripped away. In terms of the family law system, there is an ideology at work, and this was found in the recent Ministry of Justice inquiry into the family law system in the UK, that there is this belief that has taken hold, this pro-contact culture, which has twisted the role of the family law courts into not making sure that children are protected and are safe and are cared for, but it is that the primary concern of those family law courts is to facilitate contact with both parents. Only if the protective parent or the parent who has been abused attempts to go for no contact with the other parent, they can sometimes be punished in the sense that the family law court sees them getting in the way of what the courts have to do. And so I know in Australia, and I've seen this happen in the UK as well, in the US too, that mothers who make abuse allegations, which are then routinely diminished and disbelieved within the family law system because they're inconvenient, because they get in the way of contact with both parents, these mothers can have their children taken away from them. So they may have their contact entirely removed. And in Australia and in the US, that contact may be removed between the children and their primary caregiver for months at a time, and the children handed over to someone that they may have said to the assessors for the court that they are terrified of. And the court has made the decision to do that so as to re-establish a connection with a parent that they deem to be unfairly punished because they've minimised or dismissed the allegations of abuse. So, I mean, this is just such a dangerous system. And I think there's a child advocate here in Australia, Hetty Johnston, who says the family law courts, in her opinion, are the most dangerous institution for children in Australia. And I have to say, when I look out across the world, the systems in the UK, Australia, the US are remarkably similar. And what's alarming is that across the UK, we've started to see more and more cases where children are removed from, particularly from their mothers, when abuse allegations have been disbelieved. And that's just an alarming development.
And what about the role of the police here? I mean, traditionally, people have assumed that the police have rather dismissed domestic abuse, you know, that awful phrase, just a domestic. But they certainly have a lot more training now than they used to in terms of how to recognise patterns and how to intervene, even if a partner isn't ready to leave. Is police behaviour improving? I mean, obviously, they're also incredibly stretched in terms of what they can deliver. Or have we still got real worries there in terms of how they handle these types of cases?
Look, I think that, you know, experts across the UK and lawyers who work on behalf of victims say that the response is still incredibly inconsistent, you know. And what I hear from victim survivors all over the world is that you can get one response from a police officer in a station one day, and then the front desk officer changes the next day and you get a completely different response. And there's a type of inconsistency and unreliability that is absolutely endangering the lives of women and children. And I when I was looking at the system of policing and what do we do to reform it, what do we do to, you know, to try to persuade reluctant police to take this seriously and to investigate it as the crime that it is, especially in the UK now that you've criminalised coercive control, that those systems of behaviours are now, as an aggregate, they're a crime, whereas 5 years ago they weren't. So what do we do to get these police officers to take this seriously? And I kind of have come to a bit of a conclusion in the book, and I say this trepidatiously because I don't want to totally write off police as they are right now, but I think that we've come to a point where you have around 20% or so victims who've experienced abuse right now have ever reported to police. So there's a serious distrust. You have the majority of serving police officers are male, whereas the majority of victims of domestic abuse are female. So you have there's a massive disconnect there. And the best solution I've seen to this, that doesn't entirely discard the model of policing but revolutionises it, is the model of women's police stations or police stations for women that are particularly prevalent across Latin America. And what they are is essentially they are police in name and they have all the investigative powers of police, but they don't report to the Minister of Police. They have no responsibility for protection of the state or of property or all the things that police, generally speaking, are trained to do. Their total focus is on protection, not on responding, and not just on enforcement. So they want to get to women in the early stages of the relationship, at the times when women are starting to go, there is something wrong here and I can't put my finger on it, but I want to talk to somebody about why I feel unsafe. And so essentially what they do is they establish themselves in brightly coloured houses within neighbourhoods. So they really embed themselves in the neighbourhoods, and they are a one-stop shop. They have financial counselling, legal counselling. They have carers there for children. They have the police, who are mostly, if not exclusively, female. And they basically have all of this in one spot so that a woman can come and tell her story, have her children cared for while she's interviewed, and not have to tell it multiple times, but also where she can work with police as to what the best course of action is. That might be that she wants to lay charges. It might be that actually she just wants to get them to go and talk to him so that he knows that he's being watched, that he's visible. Or it might be that she wants them to go and remove him from the house. And I think what's really evident in these police stations for women is the results that they've had. And in the neighbourhoods where they're present, I think this was a study done in Brazil, the overall domestic homicide rate had dropped by 17%. But in the metropolitan areas, it was even more stark. It was like somewhere up around 50%, but especially for young women. And that tells us that those women, before they get locked in and before they, you know, necessarily have children, that they are getting to these, that the police are getting to them and are able to engage them early, because they're not waiting for a crime to be committed. They want to be engaged on what is happening inside that relationship from as early as possible. And we know that's the best way you can possibly prevent future homicide.
Jess, I think that's a great place to finish. Thank you so much. And thank you to Intelligence Squared. Listeners can find more out about the book via the link in the episode description.